salt of the world.
What does that mean, that the Christian is the salt of the earth? He preserves society wherever he is. Salt was used to preserve in those days before we had refrigerators and freezers and that kind of thing. So salt was rubbed into the fish or the meat of some other sort in order to preserve it. It wouldn't do anything if corruption had already occurred to get rid of that corruption, but it would do something to keep it from becoming corrupt. And wherever a Christian is, if he's living as a Christian, he adds salt into that situation and preserves things from getting any worse than they were beforehand. What about the light of the world? If Christians are the light of the world, what are they doing? Showing others the way to Christ. And as light, they do not hide their light under a bushel, but they set it on a lampstand where it can be seen and give light to the whole house. The idea is to let that light so shine that men may glorify our Father which is in heaven. They may come and say, something's happened in that person's life, and find the message of salvation is basic to what has happened, and trust in Christ and glorify the Father which is in heaven. Then we began to look at what followed that, the idea that Jesus did not come to abolish the law, but rather to fulfill it. What does it mean that he came to fulfill rather than to abolish the law? Fulfilling the law means pardon me? Yes, that's part of it, but also yes, yes. Showing the broader and deeper meaning of the law in contrast to what the Pharisees and the scribes had done. The scribes and the Pharisees looked at only the outward letter of the law and fulfilled it only in some external form, which Paul talks about in his second letter to Timothy, being a form of godliness, but not having the power thereof. Jesus is showing the power of godliness as it reaches not the problem manifest in society, but the problem with which that problem begins, namely what is in the heart of man. And so we looked next at the question of murder. And people said in those days, well, you shall not murder. And they added a little to it. If you are, you're likely to be liable to a court trial. Well, what did Jesus say about that? How did he broaden and deepen and show the true meaning of this commandment of God? I'm getting two things here. Let's take ladies first. Pardon me? If you hate your brother, you're violating this commandment. He traced murder back to its source, the heart of man where hatred grows and manifests itself. And what did he say about these trials and so on? He said, if you hate in your heart, you ought to be subject to a court trial. You deserve to be. And if you express that even with minimal comments like raka, some little mumbling thing under your breath, about somebody else, you deserve to be brought before the Sanhedrin. And if you call somebody a fool, in the full Old Testament sense of that word, which means you're a pagan, a heathen, who acts that way in life, even though you claim to be a believer, that you deserve to not even have a burial at your trial, but you deserve to be thrown into Gehenna, where there was fire and trash and garbage and everything else. That was strewn around and burned south of Jerusalem in that valley. So Jesus is saying that the commandment is much deeper, much fuller, and he is fulfilling it in his life, and he is telling us what the commandment means. That it's not some superficial external conformity to the law outwardly that he's talking about, but he's talking about hatred itself is murder. And remember, in 1 John, we quoted the passage that says, whoever hates his brother has murdered him in his heart. And that means that there are murderers here in this auditorium tonight. There are people here who have hated another person in the heart. And so, the commandments of God are very deep and very rich. And we've got to understand how extensively they reach into the very corners and crevices of a human life. Again, tonight we have another example of that as Jesus in a second way is showing how the commandment goes beyond the outward or external observance. We turn to Matthew 5:27 tonight. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you, whoever looks at a woman with the intention of desiring her already has committed adultery with her in his heart. Boy, that is a sweeping commandment, isn't it? We have a lot about adultery in our society today. I just cut this week out of the paper. It says, Charles admits adultery, but still will be king. The headline. He was free enough to admit his adultery. And it was interesting what kind of response he got when he admitted that he was an adulterer. People were quizzed on television over there in Britain. And there were a lot of people who said, well, we like the fact that he came forth with this. He was honest about it. That's the kind of man we want for king. Well, that's our society today. It's gone beyond the Pharisaical kind of society in which, as long as you kept the outward aspects of the commandment, you were okay. Today, you don't even have to keep the outward aspects of the commandment. Today, we have a wide open society, practically world round, in which adultery is accepted and in which it is looked upon as something not all that serious after all. Well, the simple statement, you shall not commit adultery, in its outward form, certainly needs to be reapplied in our day and our time. The wide open sin of our culture today, that which used to be under the counter now is on top of the counter, is certainly evidence of that. But Jesus doesn't stop there. He goes on to say that if you have the intention of desiring a woman in your heart, looking on her, you've already committed adultery with her in your heart. The commandment covers more than the act. The Pharisees had relaxed the commandment to mean only the act. So he sees behind the act to the lust, the desire that becomes the impetus for this act. The essence of what he says is that God permits all sexual intimacy out of marriage and everything that leads to it. That's what Jesus is telling us here in these words. Now, how can you avoid the passions and desires of the flesh in this area? As we live in a society that's so wide open, in a society that in every way seems to be intent upon getting everybody to become lustful and thus adulterous in his or her heart, what can you do? Well, Jesus puts the emphasis upon looking. Whoever looks at a woman with the intention of desiring her already has committed adultery with her in his heart. There's something about looking that stirs the passions. And Jesus knew that. And people know that today. Publishers and directors of TV programs, people who publish magazines and books, and who direct movies, and who also compose advertisements in our day, as well as pornographic materials, all exploit the fact that the eye is the avenue through which lust is stirred. The eye. But that's nothing new. 2 Peter 2:14 speaks about eyes full of adultery. People whose eyes are full of adultery because they're looking the way Jesus said nobody should. And the interesting thing is that in the book of Job, probably the earliest book of the Bible written, in verse 1 of chapter 31, Job says, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look on a woman. The problem has been age old. It's not just something in a wide open, sinful society like ours. But even in those days, it was a problem. It's always been one of the problems. And so God, early on, gave us a commandment, which he said, you shall not commit adultery. And Jesus explains that commandment as extending to looking on a woman to lust after her. The interesting thing about this is that today it's the other way around as well. Maybe it always was, but it's even being emphasized on television ads where you have some hairy-chested brute standing there and drinking a Pepsi Cola or a Coke or something, and these gals up there on the top lusting after this fellow. It's an interesting world in which we live. But lust is something we need to overcome. How do you do that? Well, what Job said still holds true. You have to stop looking. You say, I can't help but look. Pick up a magazine and there it is. Drive down the street, there's a billboard and there it is. Turn on the television and there it is. Look at an advertisement and there it is. Go to the beach and there it is. Everywhere you turn, there's something hitting you square in the eyeball and saying to you, here is a temptation to commit adultery in your heart. It is not, and this is important for you to understand, it is not adultery to see something wrong. Jesus saw what you and I see. Job saw what you and I see. When Peter talked about eyes full of adultery, he saw what the rest of us see in the forms that it took in his day and age. To see something wrong is not what is wrong. But in any way to entertain what you see so as to somehow or other wallow in it, thinking thoughts about it, taking the second or third or fourth look, or the wrong kind of look. That's what Jesus is talking about. He's talking about adultery being eyes that are full of what they see. Not eyes that simply see something and then turn another direction, but eyes that are opening up wider so as to get more. Eyes full of adulterous sights and thoughts in the heart. So, you can't help seeing. You're inundated by all sorts of sinful appeals to the eye. We live in a virtual flood of it in our society, but you don't have to continue looking at it. You don't have to look past what you see to somehow or other giving consent to the wrong things that might be involved in what you see. And Jesus then adds a couple appendices, as he did before, to this that deal with the question of adultery. He says in verses 29 and 30, so if your right eye causes you to stumble, tear it out and throw it away from you. It is to your advantage to have one of your members perish than for your whole body be thrown into Gehenna. If your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away from you. It is to your advantage to have one of your members perish than for your whole body to go away into Gehenna. We talked about this in the counseling course a few weeks back from one perspective. I want to look at it from another perspective tonight. What he's saying is to make this problem more difficult for you to indulge in. Tear your eye out. If your eye's your problem, gouge it out and throw it away. And if it's your right eye even, your most important eye, the one you sight with when you go hunting, tear that out. We don't mind hunting in this society here, in this church here, and we're not politically correct. We even have rubber ducks that you can shoot at down here if you want to. But your right eye, the most important eye, your left-handed, of course, make the transition, is the one that offends, and tear it out. Well, what does he mean? He's not speaking literally, of course. He doesn't mean chop your right hand off or your right foot off or tear your right eye out literally. But what he's saying is, make it so, A, that you will not slide into this sin unwittingly. If you always did something or other, whatever it was, with that eye, and that eye is now missing, when you go to do it again, you will become aware immediately that you are sliding into that sin. If you always did something with that right hand and it is chopped off, you will become immediately aware when you reach over with your stump to try to do it, and you can't because your hand isn't there, that you are sliding once again into that sin. So he wants you to do something that will make you aware of your temptation and that you will not simply drift into it by habit. But also, he's saying, you have to be concerned enough about this if this is a problem and this is a difficulty to do something to make it difficult for you to sin that way again. Now, tearing the eye out isn't going to keep you from sinning because the lust is in the heart. But the picture is that since you see these things with your eye, then get rid of whatever it is that, like that eye, brings the temptation into the heart. And so if there are things that lead to this sinful lust of the heart, they need to be amputated, radically amputated if necessary. Some of the most valuable things, like your right eye, your right hand, need to be amputated. If there are pornographic materials that some of you have been indulging in, that some of you have been looking at, things that you have stuffed away and pull out from time to time, you better get rid of that stuff like yesterday. That's what our Lord is saying. You have no place for that. You need to tear that out, throw it away, burn it up, get rid of it so nobody else is influenced by it. Sometimes it's not only pornographic materials, it's some other seemingly legitimate materials that have the same effect, that nobody looking at them necessarily would think would do this to you, but they do. Get rid of them, like yesterday. If you have practices and you have habits that you have fallen into, then you've got to get rid of those practices and get rid of those habits, like yesterday. Our Lord is saying, you shall not commit adultery. And he's saying that if you look at a woman with the intention of desiring her already, you have committed adultery in your heart. So get rid of those things which lead to that kind of lust in the heart. Of course, it's not, as I say, the cutting off of the hand or the gouging out of the eye, because the virus of lust works too deeply for real surgery to repair. So it's not just a matter of confessing your sin, it's a matter of buttressing yourself against that sin in the future by getting rid of anything that leads to it. Who knows what leads to it? There are people with fetishes of all sorts. People, if they see a shoe or get a certain kind of material they rub their hands on or whatever it may be, have problems as a result. Oh, we've got any fetish type people here? Not probably not. But it could be. You never know. These things are done behind the scenes, covertly. Whatever it is the point. And it could be some strange thing like that that leads to your temptation. Get rid of it. That's what God said. Well, while the Pharisees didn't change the commandment, they relaxed it. So he gave a second example and rider or addition to that, which shows a complete distortion of the Old Testament as they quoted it. In verse 31, he says, "And it was said, whoever divorces his wife must give her a written record of the divorce. But I tell you that everyone who divorces his wife except on the ground of sexual sin makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." Here is a further explanation of the seventh commandment. The Pharisees dipped into Deuteronomy 24, from which they extracted this phrase to give her a written record of a divorce. However, that isn't what he said. Moses didn't write those words as they are presented here. Whoever divorces his wife must give her a written or record of a divorce. That was not what Deuteronomy 24 said at all. Deuteronomy 24 was talking about something entirely different, and they turned what Deuteronomy 24 was talking about into something that it wasn't talking about. They turned it into a permission for divorce on any cause, virtually any cause. So they quote a portion of Deuteronomy 24 as if a commandment were given at that point about a bill of divorce, and that's all that's necessary if you want to get rid of your wife. Deuteronomy 24 says, if because of something or other that you don't like in your wife, you divorce her, and if she marries a second person, and if the second person divorces her or dies, then you can never marry her again. That's what Deuteronomy 24 says. And incidentally, along the way, it says, if you divorce her by giving her a bill of divorcement and putting it into her hand, that is, you legitimately divorce her because that's the way it was done, and if this takes place, and if that takes place, then that's what Deuteronomy 24 is talking about, not the way they used it at all. And so he's saying, look, you have opened up divorce so widely, so a Mack truck could drive through it. Jesus is narrowing the causes for divorce here. He's not going along with Hillel and his crowd. Hillel's view was that you could divorce your wife if she burned the toast. Literally, if she burned your meal. Didn't speak about toast, but burning the meal. If you preferred another woman, Hillel said, and his disciples believed and practiced. You preferred some other woman, you could divorce your wife for that reason. If she neglects her household duties, if there's a layer of dust on things and she doesn't dust it off, you can divorce your wife, said Hillel. And this was because in that Deuteronomy 24 passage, it spoke about an erwath tavar, a thing of uncleanness. And that meant something less than a legitimate reason for divorcing. So that if a man, for a reason that is not adequate, divorces his wife, and she marries another, and then he divorces her or he dies, she cannot remarry the first man, is what Deuteronomy 24 says. It was an illegitimate divorce that Deuteronomy 24 was talking about. A divorce that took place for an erwath davar, something that the person himself found unpleasant. And so they took this, turned it around in exactly the opposite direction, and took what was condemning remarriage and divorce, and made it the cause for remarriage and divorce. No. Jesus says, unless there is sexual sin involved, there is no legitimate cause among God's people for divorce. Paul adds something else. Jesus is talking here, of course, to the covenant community. And Paul says, I'm going to tell you something Jesus didn't talk about because it wasn't apropos to the situation that he was talking about. I'm going to talk about, he says in 1 Corinthians 7, the situation where you have a believer and an unbeliever. He doesn't recommend that a believer marry an unbeliever, but if there were two unbelievers and one of them got converted, Paul says we've got to deal with that kind of situation where the unbeliever doesn't want to go on with the marriage and wants to get rid of the believing partner, perhaps even because he has or she has become a believer. In that case, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7:15, the believer should let that person go, and that believer is no longer bound because God has called us to peace. So there are only two causes that are legitimate for divorce: sexual sin, and when an unbeliever no longer wants to continue a marriage with a believer. That's the way Jesus and the New Testament tighten up divorce. Whereas Pharisees in those days were finding every little loophole possible, burning the toast, preferring another, household duties not done to my specification. Maybe you've heard that little ad about the fellow finding a cobweb underneath of the filing cabinet. That could be a cause for divorce. But Jesus said that was all wrong. That was a misinterpretation. And if you divorce somebody on that basis and she goes and marries another, that causes her to commit adultery because she still belongs. She still should be with the first husband. And so, here was some more looseness about the seventh commandment. Jesus is filling out all kinds of things here we need to know about, telling us how God expects us to live in this world. Men, you may not like the way your wife keeps house. You may not like the way that she does the toast. But you're going to live with her, or you're going to be committing adultery if you get rid of her and marry somebody else. That's what Jesus is saying. Yes.